Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. A hyperscale data center just approved by the Box Elder County Commission is making headlines, but according to the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute, there are 48 data centers in operation in Utah, 7 under construction, more being proposed. Proponents tout advantages of these centers, such as jobs and economic development in rural areas. But today on the program, we'll hear the case against data centers in Utah. We hope to have Dr. Brian Mensch, president of Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, on during the program here. We have with us in studio USU Associate Professor of Physics, Robert Davies. Robert Davies, thanks. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
I think you want to make clear at the beginning here, you're not speaking for USU in this.
That's right. Certainly I have some expertise relevant to it as a result of my work, my professional work, but I am not, of course, speaking for the university.
So I didn't know there were that many data centers already in operation. Of course, several being proposed. And you were reminding me before we went on the air, Dr. Davies, that this isn't the only hyperscale data center being proposed in Utah.
No, in addition to this, and I think I want to emphasize that this, the one in Box Elder County, is every bit of that word hyperscale, which is the word the developers themselves are using, and the state at 9 billion watts, roughly twice the scale of energy consumption in the entire state of Utah. But there are two others of roughly that scale proposed, as I understand it, in Millard County.
So let's start with the one that's gotten all the news here, the Box Elder County, this over in Hansel Valley, the sleepy little valley in Box Elder County. It's going to be, this goes forward, going to be a lot less sleepy. Let's talk about, first of all, the heat island. That there's an article in the Salt Lake Tribune recently. Leah Larson interviewed you. This was intriguing, alarming. Tell us about this.
Right. So first I want to make something else clear. I'm not actually here in opposition to data centers in general. Certainly there are pros and cons, and I think we're looking at some of the questions that are alarming and need to be asked and we would like to answer as we move forward. So certainly there are concerns, as there would be with any large-scale project. So the heat island effect is what I noticed as once this became public, only just a couple of weeks ago really, that most of us heard about it, was the enormous energy scale. And most of the so this is two things we want to be clear. This is a 9 gigawatt, which is massive, data center, but it's being powered by its own off-grid natural gas power plant. So you've got these two things. And the natural gas power plant's about 50% efficient. So in order to give the data center 9 gigawatts, it's going to have to burn through primary energy of about 16 to 18 gigawatts. And so that's the total thermal load. All of that energy turns into heat essentially immediately in the process of producing the energy and then in the process of using that energy. And while a lot of the conversation that I was reading about was around water use, and rightly so, typically these kinds of facilities would use enormous amounts of water to cool them, to dissipate that heat. The project's developers have alluded to the fact that they're not going to be using anywhere near that amount of water, and there is technically a way they can do that, which is through dry air cooling. So instead of dumping all that excess, all that heat, that 16 gigawatts, now we're talking about a total of 2 to 3 times the amount of the rest of Utah combined, into this small area, they would have to essentially have several hundred acres of industrial scale fans cooling, kind of like a radiator, essentially the way your car works, but on a much, much grander scale, of course. And so that thermal load is really massive. At 16 gigawatts, this would be one of the largest single-point thermal sources on the planet. And so the question is, where does that go? It can go into tributaries, into the aquifer, or it can go into the air. And so since the developers were implying that it was going to go into the air, I was interested in figuring out, kind of bracketing, what does that do to the local climate there in the Hansel Valley?
Before we get into your calculations, I guess just I want to lean just a little bit more on the scale here. You said in this article, it's kind of hard to wrap our minds around the scale.
It is. We're, you know, you try to find all kinds of analogies to help people understand it. So 40,000 acres is what the developers say the entire campus will be. This is where the buildings and the data center and additional facilities and the power plant will be housed. That's the physical footprint of about 2,000 Walmart supercenters. But the energy footprint is much larger. Again, 16 gigawatts. That's the energy footprint of about 40,000 Walmart supercenters. So your footprint of 2,000 Walmart supercenters stacked 20 deep. It's the energy footprint of about 2.5 New York cities. And it's the equivalent of dumping about 23 atomic bombs worth of energy into the valley every day. So obviously these aren't explosions, but that's an awful lot of energy. And we're trying to get our brains around how much that is in a quite a confined area, and then figuring out what does that do to the local environment.
So that's another key. This is a bowl, right? It's a valley. So
it's a valley.
So what? Yeah. What did you find? What do you think?
So I approached it from several different ways. I have to emphasize that all of this is. I had media was calling. Various members of the public were calling, wondering, and it's a fairly straightforward energy calculation to start with. I can do it several different ways, which I did. But the upshot is, you look at potential. This is dumping the energy into the air, as we understand it, and think of again. Hundreds of acres. It's essentially a giant hairdryer blowing 130-degree air into the valley 24/7. So daytime temperature elevation, maybe a few degrees Fahrenheit in this 600-square-kilometer valley. But where the real concern came, and that's significant in and of itself, but at nighttime, the nighttime elevated temperature is something in the order of 8 to 12 degrees Fahrenheit. And that is a very large essentially permanent nighttime climate change. It's important to a high desert environment and ecosystem because what happens daily is, as we all know, the deserts get warm during the day, but they cool off because the air is dry at night. And they cool off down to the dew point, which means you get condensation. So you have this daily condensation cycle, and that's where the ecosystem, all the insects and critters and plants and animals get a lot of their water is from that daily condensation cycle. If you raise temperatures 8 to 10 degrees, 12 degrees Fahrenheit essentially permanently, it's going to have a big effect on that condensation cycle, essentially shutting it down in parts of the valley. So to get a better understanding of how much of the valley that affects and how often one has to do much more detailed modeling. But already these indications are that essentially, as you would expect, dumping that much energy into quite a confined place, it's going to have an effect. And this analysis suggests that, yeah, that effect is actually going to be quite significant. Mm.
Including potential ecological changes, changing the environment of that valley, potentially.
You know, we could talk to some ecologists, which I have, but I think I can safely say that this scale will have definite ecological effects that are not small. In fact, the ecologists I've been speaking to use the word transformative. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a 30-year project. So imagine you've got this this giant 400-acre hairdryer blowing your hot air into the valley for 30 years. It's not hard to imagine that that is quite transformative to an ecosystem. And we have to remember that this is an ecosystem, the Great Salt Lake Basin, that is already in a fairly advanced stage of ecological and hydrological collapse.
Mm-hmm. Leo Larson talked to Ben Abbott at BYU. He we don't know, of course, but he theorized that there could be enough change that it could be just producer of dust now.
So there are a number of challenges here. So certainly one, suppressing that what's called diurnal condensation pump, where you get the overnight condensation every day or most days, has its own drying effect, right? We're no longer getting the moisture out of the atmosphere and putting it into the watershed. So that has its own drying effect. But then just imagine blowing this hot air. You're just raising the temperature permanently, and warmer air holds more moisture. So when you increase air temperature a little, evaporation intensifies quite a lot. It's what we call a nonlinear relationship. And so these temperature changes of a few degrees to 10 or 12 degrees are really quite significant. So that's an additional drying effect, a desiccating effect for the ecosystem and for the watershed.
Mm. So what about, of course, you haven't done, I don't think you've done calculations for the ones in Millard County. These hyperscale would be similar in scope. Out there, a couple of them, I guess. That's not necessarily a bowl, right? Not necessarily a valley.
You know, I haven't looked at either of them, but we'll just, in particular, so I'm not sure what the geology is there and the geography. But as a first pass, we can say that it's a similar, the local climate will be substantially affected. We're talking about somewhere between 9 and 16 gigawatts, depending on how you're generating the energy, et cetera, and then where you're dumping the – I don't know where they're dumping the energy. I don't know if they're dumping it into the ground, into an aquifer, if they're using water cooling, if they're using dry air cooling. All of that makes a difference. But we can kind of put all of that aside and just say that these are massive energy sources – thermal sources. It takes a lot of waste heat to generate electricity. So there's that immediately. And as soon as you use that electricity, it turns into heat. And in these projects, unlike, say, a regular power plant where you're generating the electricity in one place, but it's being used all over the place, right? And hundreds of miles away and in lots of different places, in your toaster and in my light bulbs and et cetera, in Logan and in Salt Lake, et cetera. These projects are different. They've got their own off-grid power plants that are feeding their own data centers, and everything is co-located. So it's in a very small area. So all of the energy is being dumped into that small area. And with these, for example, in Millard, similar scale with a similar energy footprint, one can expect significant effect.
And again, the scale, so if you have not one but three of these plants, each of them double what the entire state of Utah is currently using.
Yeah.
That's huge scale.
It is an enormous scale. And so right now we're just talking about the thermal load. And of course there are water concerns. Of course there are air quality concerns. The water concerns, by the way, aren't simply volumetric. So going back to the project in Box Elder, they've talked about using closed loop systems, kind of like a radiator in your car, right? You've got a radiator and you've filled the cooling system with a certain amount of liquid and you just keep recirculating that liquid. It goes through the engine, picks up the heat, goes over to the radiator and dumps off the heat into the air and then just keeps recirculating. You can do that also, say, underground in an aquifer. Instead of dumping the energy into the air, you can dump it into underground water, which is much more efficient cooling. Water sucks up an awful lot of energy compared to air. And you cannot be changing the volume of water of the basin and in the watershed, but you're dramatically changing the quality of the water by adding so much heat to it. And again, these water systems support a whole ecosystem that has evolved over many, many thousands of years for the environment that it's in. And now all of a sudden you change that thermal environment fairly dramatically, that's going to affect the ecosystem. It's not evolved to deal with temperatures like that.
Hmm. So the Box Elder hyperscale, I don't know what they're saying it's going to be water cooled or is it going to be air cooled?
The implication is that it's air cooled. Called dry air cooled, and this is maybe useful for everyone to know. There's kind of a couple of different ways you can do air cooling. One of them is evaporative cooling. So the idea is you pipe in water, it soaks up the heat from the data center and from the power plant and evaporates. And this is how, you know, our bodies cool themselves. We sweat and the water evaporates. And when that happens, it's very efficient cooling because water, again, absorbs an awful lot of energy. And then to convert it into vapor, it carries it away. It's a very efficient way to cool, but it consumes an awful lot of water. This would be many tens of thousands of acre feet for a project this size, something on the order of, I think, 100,000 acre feet to just what's called wet cool the system. So you're still dumping the energy into water and the water goes into the air. The dry cooled doesn't use that water bit. It just blows air over radiators, very similar to the way your car radiator works. It's much less efficient. But it doesn't consume nearly as much water, and I think that's the concern here.
Mm-hmm. And that has been a big concern, the large water consumption, right? That this one and you know, a lot of them going forward say they're going to do air cooling, I think, because trying to solve that problem of consumption of large bits of water. There's still problems, is what you're saying.
Well, it's just very inefficient, and particularly inefficient in this environment because we're in a desert. And so basically you're trying to cool a hot radiator by blowing hot air over it. Mm. and so particularly in the summer months when the air temperature in the Hans Valley is in the 90s or even over 100 degrees, you have to basically use more of your energy that you're generating, not for the thing you want to use it for, which would be the data center, but for running the fans and the cooling system. And you could lose, you know, up to 15 or 20% of your energy just for that. So it's just much less efficient from an engineering standpoint. But then, of course, from an ecological standpoint, you have the implications that I raised a little bit earlier. You're changing the climate. Now, if you dump that into the water instead, again, you may be not consuming water from a volume standpoint, but you're consuming it from a standpoint of changing its quality. It's now water that is much higher temperature, significantly higher temperature for the aquatic system. That is not a different ecological challenge. It's not a smaller one.
Would you say you're just raising concern? You're not necessarily against the concept of a data center. Would you say data centers are okay in general if you have plenty of water and it's not going to change the climate as much as in a desert here?
You know, Tom, it's a nice segue into, I think, the question that we really want to be moving into, and that this particular project, it gives us sort of specific focus on, but is a gateway into the much larger question which you've just asked. So I should say that, you know, doing thermal analysis of data centers and power plants is not my day job, really. I'm certainly trained as a physicist, and these are not very difficult. From an energy standpoint, it's actually a fairly straightforward analysis. The world that I work in is a world of complex systems, and we're talking about systems that have thresholds. So they're stable under a certain amount of disruption, but if you disrupt them a little too much, they become unstable. And certainly ecosystems work in this way. Our human civilizational systems work this way. And so what you've broken into is this question. Let me reframe the question. You asked about data centers in general. And so we could talk about the Great Salt Lake Basin and then broaden out from there. But let's start with just the Great Salt Lake Basin as a focal point of that. We have this tendency to do this, what economists would call a marginal analysis, but a piece-by-piece analysis or a project analysis of what does this particular project, what is the impact? So we have lots of demands on the Great Salt Lake Basin. We've got residential, we've got industrial, we've got agricultural demands. All have impacts on air quality, on water consumption, on ecological health. And we tend to take these projects on a project-by-project basis and say, what is the impact, say, to air quality or to the thermal load or to the ecosystem or to water consumption of this project? And we do this on a piece-by-piece basis, and we keep coming up with numbers that seem like they're not too bad. Now, this project is a little different because it's so big. But it's kind of like our cable bill or our internet bill, right? There's a show that we want to watch, and it's on Hulu, and we don't have a subscription to Hulu. And you look at it, and you say, well, it's just another $5 or $6 or whatever it is. No, there's this thing on Disney, but that's only another $3 or $4 or $15, whatever it is for that particular thing. And we make this decision on a marginal basis, on a case-by-case basis. Whereas what we really want to be doing is saying, what is my capacity to pay for this entertainment in total, my financial capacity in total, or maybe just my financial capacity in total, and what is my remaining capacity and how much do I want? And do I want to spend my remaining capacity on this particular Netflix or Hulu or Disney or whatever it is? And that's a kind of a different analysis, right, other than this is only a little bit. So taking it back to your question, let's look at the Box Elder data center. Rather than do it in this marginal case, just look at what is the impact of this particular project on water consumption, on air quality, on ecological impact, on local climate and thermal load. A better way for us to look at it is say this entire basin has demands on it, agricultural, industrial, residential. It provides for us a tremendous amount of economic activity and delivers to us a tremendous amount of well-being. And I think the question we want to be asking is, what is the total capacity of this basin to that we can ask of this basin to give us things that we're asking of it? And is there remaining capacity? And I would argue that that's a very serious question in this case, because this is a system that is already in an advanced stage of ecological and hydrological collapse. But if there is remaining capacity, the question is how do we want to use that capacity? Is this project what we want to be doing it with? And I think that's the broader question for data centers around the country. We already have an enormous energy footprint here in the United States, an enormous consumptive footprint. And these systems are finite, and they do have thresholds beyond which you push them and they become unstable and change in ways that you don't want them to change. And so with the data center, the data centers are a focal point because they are so enormous. They are so rapidly increasing our energy demand. And that has lots of effects. The reason we're building these centers with now off-grid power plants is because in the places where they're building them and connecting them to the grid, they're raising energy rates. Mm-hmm. And again, it's what's the capacity we have in, let's say, Ohio. And we build this data center and connect it to the grid. Do we have extra capacity? And if we do, is this what we want to use it for? Or does this mean that you're not going to be able to use your air conditioner for 3 hours a day or 5 hours a day, or that you're going to have to pay quite a little bit more to do that? So this is what I would call a more whole systems analysis, and this is what we want to be doing. I think as a society is looking at a whole systems analysis, not just a project-by-project analysis, and saying, what are our resources, and how do we want to – what is the capacity we have, and how do we want to use that capacity? And you know, for AI, is it really clear that this is something we need, that this is something that's bringing real benefit to us that we need? And I think that's an open question.
Mm. Like in support of your whole system analysis plea here, I don't know if I'm just uneducated, but I think I'm somewhat representative. If you'd have asked me before I did some research for this program, how many data centers do we have already? I would have said, 15, 20. Mm-hmm. Those are what I've heard going in. Actually, according to Kemp C. Gardner Policy Institute, 48. We already have 48.
Just in the state of Utah.
Just the state of Utah, right? Yeah. So piecemeal, you're not looking at the whole picture.
Yeah, that's right. And so – and you brought it up. Now with just three additional projects that are proposed that are much bigger than the projects that are in operation right now, we could – essentially raise the state's electricity consumption by a factor of 6, as you mentioned, with just these three. And by the way, if you're interested in other things besides just the energy consumption, but these are natural gas powered to various degrees, the project in Box Elder, the Stratos project that's gotten all the press, will raise the carbon emissions from the state of Utah by 50% all by itself. And then add in these other two projects, and I'm not sure how much of them are powered by fossil fuels. I think probably most. Mm-hmm. You're raising it again. So roughly speaking, these three projects, I think we can estimate, will double our carbon emissions. And of course, we're in a state that is being strongly affected by the changing climate. I think this past winter is a good example of that. The state of the Great Salt Lake is partly due to that. As you and I sit here, Tom, the temperature outside is 23 degrees above normal for this time of year. And this is not just a one-day thing. This is a long-term trend that we're seeing. So clearly there are trade-offs that are being made, and you don't see those unless you do the whole systems analysis.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break. We're overdue for a break. We'll come back with more with Robert Davies, USU Associate Professor of Physics. Looking at concerns about the data centers, this report from Kemp C. Gardner Policy Institute, 48 already online, seven proposed, and there are more past that. So quite a few. A parting shot in this segment. According to this report, the National Electricity Reliability Corporation projects that Utah will face elevated grid risk in 2031, where electricity supply shortfalls may occur even under extreme conditions. We're talking about that's one concern. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Of course, we're talking a lot on this program behind the headlines that all media has. Hyperscale data center was just approved by Box Elder County Commission. That's making all the headlines. We're trying to look as a whole in Utah, what's going on with data centers. According to ChemC Gardner Policy Institute, there are 48 data centers in operation in Utah, seven under construction, more being proposed. Other hyperscale, the two hyperscale data centers being proposed for Millard County, for example. There's a big one. I'm not sure what the scale is for near Cedar City, for example. It's got some people concerned there. And, of course, advantages being touted, such as jobs, economic development in rural Utah, and other advantages. The state leaders, Republicans in the legislature, Governor Cox have said that we're in a kind of an arms race with artificial intelligence with China. We need to keep up in the United States. But we're hearing a voice of caution. Need to take a minute to look at things is what Robert Davies says. He's the USU associate professor of physics, and he joins us here. Let's start with this. You're talking before we went on break, Dr. Davies, about your hope that we could do a systems analysis in a whole. And you pointed out during the break that your analysis, the Heat Island analysis of this one data scale project, is only that. It's just the one project.
It's just the one project, and it was kind of a what we might call a quick and dirty analysis. Again, it wasn't particularly difficult. The energy physics here isn't complicated, but it also tells us showed that the potential for very large impact is big. And so I think from a decision process, from a democratic decision-making process, and from some kind of a risk management perspective, of course, when you have a project that is touted by its developers themselves as hyperscale, and it is every bit of that, as we've talked about, this is just a massive energy load for the environment. And you want to maybe take a beat and make sure you get the assessment correct. And so I think one of the concerns that I certainly have as a citizen here of Cache Valley and of Northern Utah and Utah in general is that it does not appear to me that no assessment of ecological impact has even been offered. And so we've gone through this very rushed process, it seems, where people have not had a lot of time to look at it. No actual analysis environmental impact has been offered, and yet it's now been approved to move forward. So it's just interesting to think that we need these kinds of results that people like me are getting are simply indications that we need to take a beat and do an actual independent whole systems analysis, which I think is really, from a risk management perspective, the only rational place to go. I've certainly heard arguments put forth in the media that we need to move fast. You mentioned China and some kind of an arms race. I have heard some of our state leaders, including the governor, make that comparison. Make a comparison to the Cold War, actually. And it's interesting that comparison got made because here in Utah, the citizens of Utah have a pretty interesting experience with rash decisions that got made in the name of national security fear-mongering, say, during the Cold War, and the above-ground nuclear testing that took place and the impacts of all of that. And it's also worth noting that, so that was the above-ground testing. It's also worth noting, I remember very well in the 80s, when this massive MX missile system was proposed for the Utah desert as part of our defense against the Soviet Union. And the state took a look at the massive scale of it and the impact of it and said, you know what, no, we don't think that we want to take a beat, we want to take a minute, we don't want to make a rash decision. It's also worth noting I used to fly airplanes in my youth. I don't fly them anymore. But pilots are trained, and I remember this training, and certainly airline pilots are trained this way. I was not an airline pilot, just a private pilot. But pilots are trained actually in an emergency to not respond too quickly. You have a chance of – and to take a bit – assess what's going on, what's happening. And so I think that's the tenor of what many people, many of us, certainly many – most of the people that I witnessed at the Box Elder meeting last week were asking for. They weren't anti-data center or pro-data center. They simply recognized the scale of it and that there had been little time to assess and wanted genuine due diligence before moving forward.
Like the fear of leaders, including, the proposed project head, Mr. Wonderful. I've forgotten his name even. I remember his his nickname. Anyway, Mr. Wonderful, we all know who he is. He has a project bogged down in Canada. And I think his fear and some state leaders' fear is, if we pause for reflection, this thing's just going to get bogged down.
Well, one person's bogged down is another person's due diligence. And the developers, of course, are – this is a private company. They're in it to make money. I don't think that any of us have any illusions that this is the way that capitalism works. This is the way that private businesses work. The motivation of the company is to make money. It's not to beat China in an arms race. It's not to improve the lives and economy of Utahns. Hopefully, if you do it right, those benefits are there. But that's not the primary motivation. I don't think that one can argue that with a straight face. And so they're going to make arguments that allow them to achieve their goal, which is to make a profit. So they might call that getting bogged down. And one way to envision a project like this is you're going to place this massive facility or many different massive facilities in a place, whether it's in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, whether it's here in the Great Salt Lake Basin, there's already enormous wealth there. And this is our sort of treasure, our ecological treasure here as Utahns, the Great Salt Lake and our mountains and our environment. It's what so many of us treasure about Logan is the wide open spaces and the beautiful landscapes and healthy, vibrant living systems. So that's a treasure that's already there. And now we put in a business, in this case an extraordinarily large facility, that is now extracting that treasure and turning it into financial treasure, not for the people of Utah, but for shareholders in a private company. And that is essentially the way our system works. I don't think we can argue that that's not the case here. Now, might there be some ancillary financial benefit for the people of Utah? Quite possibly. They've promised 2,000 jobs and something like $80 or $90 million of tax revenue. That's what's coming from the developers. I think that requires independent analysis. There's always leakage in those kinds of things. I think we can probably assume there's not going to be 2,000 jobs. There's not going to be $90 million. But there's going to be something. What is that? Let's do an independent analysis of what that is. But that's the benefit part. Let's also do the cost part. What do we have to give in return? And I think what I see in this case is a potential for a massive extraction of our public treasure and funneling it into the financial treasure of just a few shareholders. That tens of millions of dollars of tax revenue is just a tiny crumb of the billions and billions of dollars that these kinds of data centers are hoped to generate for their shareholders.
Mm. I want to throw a bit of a curveball at you here, possibly an ethical question. Say, members of our audience here, and I suspect there are some, maybe many, don't approve of, because of many concerns that we've been articulating here, the big data centers. Should we then be seeking out and using the tools that are created, these AI tools? I think, I Google stuff and it brings up, hey, these answers provided by AI. And I've found that they're probably more extensive and better than the regular Google search, you know. So I'm benefiting, I suppose. Should I boycott that if I don't approve with the data centers?
You know, it's an interesting question, and it brings up a realm of systems analysis and called game theory. And game theory looks at sort of the interactions between competing actors under conditions of imperfect knowledge. So trying to figure out and the framing that we typically use in our society is what we'll call a finite game, where the goal is to win. There's a winner and there's a loser, and so you're competing. And that's certainly how this has been framed, competing businesses, competing with each other. Google's introduced AI, Microsoft's introduced AI, Apple now feels the need to introduce, they're competing. And in that framing, if you're stuck in a system like that and a technology comes along that provides you with a competitive advantage, and certainly AI can do that. Then if you want to stay competitive, then the adoption of that technology becomes obligate. You can choose not to, but that just deals you out of the game. You get absorbed or conquered, bought out, driven out of business, et cetera. So, so now we can apply that to the situation that we're in. Certainly the proponents, the marketing forces that are driving forward these proposals are doing so using the tools of AI for analysis and for and we know that in business. This is mostly what AI is being used for, is driving very highly targeted marketing to people through algorithms on social media, et cetera. And this is what it's getting used for. Those of us right now, you mentioned Googling something. It's you. I'm not even sure how to opt out of using it. Like if I just want to do a Google search, mm-hmm. It seems to be automatic. Yeah. I've actually tried to find a way to. I can ask the AI, how do I opt out of using the AI?
Right. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the point is that it's here, and there's no question that it can confer advantage. It can help us move through analyses much quicker. It can help us respond in good faith to arguments that are being put out there, whether those arguments are in good faith or not in good faith, but it can help us respond. If we choose not to use it, but the what is considered to be the opposition is using it, then you're kind of dealing yourself at a disadvantage right away. It's kind of like asking, is it okay for climate activists to climb on airplanes and fly around? The problem is we're embedded in a system, and we are sort of forced to use the tools of that system. We can try not to, but the system pushes us to use those tools. And if you don't, you spend more and more of your time trying to resist it, and you become less and less effective at trying to do what it is you're trying to do. So it's a fair question. I think one has to be considered about how we use these tools. When do I climb on an airplane and for what purpose? When do I choose to engage with AI and for what purpose? But at this stage of the game, it's really difficult if you're trying to be effective to not have to use the tools that are now embedded in the system.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with a brief final segment with Robert Davies. We are looking at the case for concern about data centers, including the hyperscale data center just approved by the Box Elder County Commission. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about data centers in Utah, and we're talking with USU Associate Professor of Physics Robert Davies. He urges caution as we look at these data centers, some positives, but there's a lot of potential negatives as well. And I guess your main message, Dr. Davies, is we need a systems analysis. Oh, I wonder, beginning this brief segment, who would do that analysis as a whole?
Well, you would need a whole team, certainly, mm-hmm. but I'm glad you said this, and I want to reemphasize, my position is not a priori pro or anti data center. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like asking if someone is pro or anti water, right? Well, we like water, but we don't like too much water, mm-hmm. and we don't like too little water. When your house is flooded, you might feel like, okay, maybe that was a little too much. It's simply the question is we need time for a scale of this project to do a whole systems analysis. What are the effects on water, on air, ecological effects on species, but what are the social effects as well? You know, again, we treasure our natural world here in Utah, and there's no question that projects of this scale alter that pretty dramatically. So when we're asked, is it worth it? I think each one of us in Utah has to try to figure out how to do an assessment. Well, and we can't do that assessment unless we know what are the impacts socially, economically, and not just narrow economic impacts, but a much broader impact. So again, a whole systems analysis. We have finite resources. We have finite availability. We can exert finite impact on our environment before these systems are disrupted beyond repair. So we need to be able to ask ourselves, what do we want to be using those resources for? And the data center is one category within a vast category of things. And we just don't have the information right now. The very large projects, they haven't had an independent analysis. So you're going to need people from a broad spectrum of disciplines to do this. And it's not like we don't know how to do that. We do. But it takes time and it takes a commitment to do that. I haven't seen a commitment to do that currently from state officials at any level, from the MITA board, from state level, even from the county level. In fact, at the county level, they essentially washed their hands of it in the statement that they made. And those assessments need to be made for us to make an informed decision. And I think that's, again, the purpose here. We need to take some time, take a beat, do this whole systems analysis independently, one that we can trust. And that's another challenge I think we have in our society right now, is a real erosion of trust. And it's processes like the process that has led us to where we are in this particular project are the reason that we've had this erosion of trust. Lots of people feel that, and I think I can say this because I was at this meeting with 1,000 or 2,000 people last week in Box Elder County, and overwhelmingly, I got there early, I left late, I heard lots of people talking. Overwhelmingly, the sentiment was, we need more information. This is all happening too fast. We feel like it's being pushed through in order to sidestep due diligence. And that doesn't do anybody any good. I don't think any of us think that's a good way to do projects. It may slow things down, but oftentimes that's a good thing.
Just have a minute left. We haven't talked about air quality. I want to make sure we at least address that concern that some people have about the data centers.
So air quality comes in, and this is certainly not my area of deep expertise. Like all of us in Utah, I have a little knowledge. It comes in a number of flavors. So we can certainly talk about pollutants in the air. You know, we're all used to PM2.5 and ozone, nitrous oxide, sulfur oxide, heavy metals from dust. But then there's also the thermal pollution. That's the calculation that I did and we talked about earlier. Just changing the nature of the air. So I think it's a huge issue, of course, and with the Great Salt Lake drying up and exposing all this dust and the heavy metals in the lake bed, well documented. Also an impact to air quality itself, an impact to the level of the Great Salt Lake. The researchers at the University of Utah have done quite a bit of work on the dust being kicked up from the exposed lake bed, melting, accelerating the melt of the snowpack in the Wasatch. And that, of course, is the watershed of the Great Salt Lake. So lots of different aspects to that. And it's just another example of the fact that when you want to do a whole systems analysis, and not just what is the air quality impact of this project, what is our total air quality situation? And if we have an increased capacity to eat into that air quality, is this what we want to use it for? Is kind of in the framing that we're in our society right now.
We'll leave it there, out of time. Much more to be said. I'm sure we'll have more programs on this. We've been talking with the USU Associate Professor of Physics, Robert Davies. Thanks so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks again, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
The Rio Grande starts high in Colorado's San Juan Mountains. The river runs south for the length of New Mexico before defining the Texas-Mexican border for 1,000 miles. A decade ago, a friend and I unloaded my canoe on the dusty banks of the Rio Grande near Lajitas, Texas, on the upstream edge of Big Bend National Park. A Border Patrol agent pulled up. His badge glistened in the January sunshine. He looked us over and smiled, trying to ease the concern on our faces. "Where are y'all from?" he asked in a friendly Texan drawl. "Utah." "How many days all y'all paddling?" "2 days, one night." The conversation continued in this manner. Eventually, I asked, "Do you have many people cross the border here?" "No," he said, "there's no reason to cross here. We only get a handful per year, and most of them don't make it across. The desert round here is too harsh. Every living thing has spikes, thorns, stingers, or fangs. I tell you, it's brutal." He wished us well and drove away. We ducked our chins and pulled our shirts up over our faces as the dust swirled past. Our canoe was a bit overloaded, but we kept our craft butter side up. Though each rapid is a new puzzle to solve, the features are familiar. Smooth tongues of water, the danger and safety of eddy lines, the way currents twist and flow over and around rocks and push against walls. We stalled on a shallow rock in Matadero Rapid. A curious fox paused to watch us round another corner. Downstream, a great blue heron flew elusively from one bank to the other, repeating this pattern in silence. Expecting a frosty night, we plucked firewood from a Mexican driftwood pile. After 11 miles, we pulled ashore, just above limestone cliffs that define the entrance of Santa Elena Canyon. The sun drooped low over the expansive Chihuahuan Desert. Shadows lengthened, and the hues of light shifted and thickened. The temperature plummeted as the sun sunk into the horizon. We fed the flames of our driftwood fire, marveling at the desolate beauty. Two owls hooted from opposite sides of the river, and the Rio Grande did what it has done for millennia, filled the air with gentle sounds of moving water. Stars soon dominated the dark sky. And there we were, on the ground in a vast wilderness, the only people for miles. We did not see another human for 2 full days. On a map, the river is an international border. 2 separate landscapes exist in the same place, the political and the wild, and neither is aware of the other. The Rio Grande River defines more than half of the U.S.-Mexico border. The Big Bend sector is the largest border patrol region in the United States. It includes 26% of the border and accounts for only 1% of apprehensions. It has the lowest number of encounters with refugees of any southern border patrol sector. Since 2016, locals have been on high alert about the possibility of a border wall through Big Bend National Park, the adjacent state parks, and through hundreds of parcels of private land. The Department of Homeland Security recently waived dozens of environmental, cultural, and public land protections to fast-track wall construction. In January, a contractor began staging heavy equipment and placing survey markers. The DHS showed a planned wall on their website that, in effect, cedes private and public land along the Rio Grande River to Mexico. Let that sink in for a moment. Locals, armed with data, advocate that highway checks, coupled with recent advanced technology, including more than 50 autonomous surveillance towers and 2 blimps, provide highly effective electronic surveillance of the border. Outfitters, ranchers, private landowners, business owners, and residents are all united in agreement that a wall would have a catastrophic impact on the local economy and the environment. Local pressure may have turned the tide for now, but no one is resting easy. Remarkably, every elected official in the 6 counties in the Big Bend sector, MAGA Republican, Republican, Democrat, and Independent, are all publicly opposed to constructing a wall in the Big Bend vicinity. This includes all 6 county sheriffs and county commissioners. That is rare common ground in our current political landscape. Additionally, judges from all 14 Texas counties along the border sent letters to the DHS asking for consistent communication, transparency, and coordination with the Big Bend border barrier. The whole concept of a wall in Big Bend is based on imaginary geography. A lack of understanding of the land, the economy, and the culture, and what actually happens or doesn't happen in the desert here. Walling the river in, walling the river out, or constructing a wall in the middle of the river, especially where 1,500 vertical foot cliffs rise from the river on either side, are all equally absurd. In the morning, after the sun burned the frost off our tents, we loaded the canoe and cast off. Engulfed by the massive walls of Santa Elena Canyon, we paddled with reverence, watching the play of light as it reflected on the river, wondering what the future holds for this wildly complex and beautiful place. Below Rockslide Rapid, a red-tailed hawk flew from one side of the river to the other and perched, unaware of both the political boundary it had crossed and the freedom it embodied. I am Eric Newell, and I am passionate about public lands and national parks.